Alright, so welcome everybody. Just to make sure everybody knows, this is the workshop where we're talking about political prisoners and prisoners of war, especially in New York State. Hopefully it's not surprising anybody. Okay, good.
Alright.
This is brought to you by Anarchist Black Cross and the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. So we're going to start off just by real quickly saying what each of those groups are. So I was going to talk about the ABC for a minute, and then Joe was going to talk about MXGM. So for those who don't know, Anarchist Black Cross has been around for over a century. It started in Russia between 1900 and 1905 and supported anarchists who were locked up in the 1905 revolution there. And then dropped off for a while, and in the 60s was resurrected in Great Britain in light of repression that anarchists were facing there. And since then, it has spread throughout the world and is on every continent. So we, right now, are part of the Anarchist Black Cross Federation, which was formed in 1995 and consists of different chapters throughout the United States and Canada. And one of our hallmark programs is the War Chest Program, where we basically give subsistence funds to a number of different political prisoners, and in some cases are their only means of financial support. These are people who have been locked up for decades, and either their families aren't around anymore, or they may not have families, and so that's like one thing that we're particularly proud of in terms of providing principled, long-term support to folks. And then, you know, as a chapter in New York, we do a bi-weekly letter writing night where we provide a vegan meal, and all that we ask is that you write one letter to a prisoner. We also do a lot of outreach. We do material support for prisoners in New York. And so that's about it for ABC. So you want to talk about MXGM?
I'm with the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. And we are an organization of Africans in America, or New Africa. Awesome. Okay. We just got to the MXGM piece. If you want to give the intro for it when you get settled. Oh, it's great. It's great. I'm glad you came.
Sorry.
It's all right.
So we're up to you can introduce MXGM much better than I ever could. I'm not even supposed to. So,
the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement is an organization of people of African descent, New Africans, that sort of work to do three things. One, promotes self-determination. Apologies, y'all, I ran over here. Two, work on building institutions for African people by African people. And the third piece is defending the human rights of African people within the empire and within the empire and across the globe. So there are many sort of pieces that takes on in terms of our work. I guess kind of most prominently, we do anti-police brutality work. We have different youth programs. We do some housing work out in Eastern New York. That's just within the New York chapter. We also have some food justice work going on. But I guess for the sake of this panel discussion, one of the things that we have been heavily supportive of is political prisoners. Prisoners of war, prisoners of conscience, as we feel that they are our freedom fighters and we demand their release. Some of the work that we do is sort of multifaceted. We do a concert every year called Black August, which is probably raises about 40 grand every year, which goes to the commissaries of our eight New York-based political prisoners. We use that as a way to entertain and also educate our people about folks like Sundiata Okoli, Jaleel Mutai King, Herman Bell. So folks come out to hear Erica or Common or Tyler, who perform for free, but what they're getting is, you know, Russell Maroon Shoke's son is coming out talking about, you know, the case of his father. Last year, the San Francisco 8, all of them came out to sort of, you know, raise awareness about their case. Two other pieces in reference to political prisoners is we do support and legal work through a coalition called the New York State Task Force on Political Prisoners, which involves people like Bob Boyle, Laura Whitehorn, Drupa Bin Wahad, Ashanti Alston, and other concerned family members, friends, and MXGM members. And basically, that coalition does a lot of work around appeals and parole hearings. So when appeals and parole hearings come up, the New York State Task Force sort of begins to heavily sort of, you know, try to get folks through those letter writings, make sure the appeals X's and O's are straight. So that's sort of task force. And then the third piece, which Joe is also a part of, is the Political Prisoner Committee, The Political Prisoner Committee basically does a lot more of the visits. So every once a month we do visitations to six of the New York State-based political prisoners, in which we take MXGM folks, family members, and community, again, because we feel it's important not only just to write them and to talk about them, but also to have that face-to-face interaction. With us being in New York, two of us having cars, luckily we can do the 6-hour and 8-hour trip to Auburn and Wendy as possible. We also do sort of similar to ABCF. You're from ABCF, right?
Yep.
We also do... no, because your face looks familiar, so I didn't want to be like... we also do letter writing campaigns for the community once a month. Usually we do the letter writing campaign before we go visit a political prisoner. So this month we're going to go visit Julia Muta King. We'll do a letter writing campaign beforehand and try to encourage people to come up and visit. And that's what I'm kind of spinning out about that.
So those are our groups. And just to give a little bit of an idea of what exactly constitutes a political prisoner or a prisoner of war, we're going to just give quick definitions, and you all can jump in, because I know MXGM might have a slightly different definition, and so let folks know two different ideas. So just real quickly, a political prisoner, as the ABCF defines it, let me just say, we're talking for, you know, probably about half an hour or so, just to give people an idea of what it's all about, and then open it up for discussion, and then also hopefully see if folks want to write maybe a quick letter to a prisoner, and we'll have information about different prisoners. And,
just start one at least if you've never done it before. It's cool, and we'll have people that you can write to and the addresses and stuff. And if you take up like a correspondence with someone, it really can like enrich your work, because like it makes people who actually have really contributed to the movement a part of your life, and you can tell them about the shit that you do, and they can tell you about the shit that they have done and advice and their elders, and like it's really helpful to hear what they have to say, and it's exponentially rewarded me. So yeah, that's the thing to get into.
Sure. Political prisoners. So a political prisoner, as we define it, is a person incarcerated for actions carried out in support of legitimate struggles for self-determination, or for opposing the illegal policies of the government and or its political subdivision. So that's why, for example, like, you know, being anarchist, we still support a number of different people who are statists or communists or whatever they might find themselves ideologically. But our reasons for doing so are that we respect the right of any people to determine their own destiny. And particularly, like, for white people, I think it's, you know, contingent upon us to support folks of color who are organizing for their freedom, and specifically, like, materially. And so that's how, like, the anarchists come to supporting folks that aren't necessarily anarchists. But in terms of self-determination, it's not just limited to what's defined as a people. I mean, self-determination means for everybody. And so for anarchist prisoners, that means trying to fight against the state, against capitalism, so that we can have self-determination. And then a prisoner of war, as distinguished from a political prisoner, are those combatants struggling against colonial and alien domination and racist regimes captured as prisoners, who are to be accorded the status of prisoner of war, and their treatment should be in accordance with the provisions of the Geneva Conventions relative to the treatment of prisoners of war. And so, for example, folks who were in the Black Liberation Army, which was a formation of folks who came out of the Black Liberation Movement in the 60s and took up arms to fight for the liberation of new African people in this country. And beyond just being political prisoners, they're taking up arms and are part of an organized movement of a colonized people, like an internal colony. Mm-hmm. The idea is that they should be accorded the same rights as all other colonized peoples have elsewhere. Like, if you look at the liberation struggles in Africa and Asia, people that are taken prisoner in those countries aren't viewed the same way as social prisoners. They're prisoners that are taken in the process of a war. And there is a war against colonized people in the U.S., I think, as probably most of us would agree.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the distinction different prisoners may claim different titles for different reasons, you know. So we always go by what they prefer. But that's the general idea from the ABCF perspective. So,
I think for us to sort of condense it a little bit, for us, you know, with POWs, folks like Sekou Odinga, sort of fall within that camp because, you know, they were defending and protecting their community, and they, you know, in terms of like, in terms of the Brinks robbery and things of that nature, that was an expropriation. Mm-hmm. That was a armed, like you said, engagement. So for us, we always kind of distinguish it, you know, if you're engaged in a sort of physical action, right? Whereas Mumia Abu-Jamal, we'll call him, we designate him as a political prisoner because what he's being charged with, you know, like Abdul-Majid will say very clearly, you know, I was engaged in X, Y, and Z action on behalf of my people, right? Mumia Abu-Jamal, on the other hand, is like, nah, I was framed, you know, because of the political organizing that I was doing. So, I mean, for us, it's sort of like, you know, obviously, it's both the same situation. Like, these are folks that are incarcerated not because of their crime, but because of their politics.
Absolutely.
But there is, I think, you know, that there is...
A criminal element to it, yeah, sometimes.
And there's also, like you said, the respect, mm-hmm, that is accorded. Because when Kwesi Baba-Goum comes before the court and says, you know, I'm a new African, you know, I'm a new African anarchist, y'all don't have jurisdiction over me, that's completely different than Seth Robert Hayes coming before the court. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think for us, we sort of say, this, you know, it's a similar sort of vein. Political prisoners are those that are, you know, that have been sort of, through conspiracy and other reasons and rationales, roped in, you know, into the court system, whereas prisoners of war clearly state, you know, I engaged in actions that were for the self-determination of my people, and I should be accorded, like you said, the rights under the Geneva Convention.
So I wanted to give, I guess, a little condensed back history, and please feel free to jump in, because I want you to.
Yeah, and just the thing we were discussing before this workshop, it's like people come from all different knowledge places, and some people know quite a bit, but are in here in a different capacity. Like, and so just if anybody wants to jump in, including us, like if we just like raise our hand, and that'll let the person speaking know that someone else wants to speak, and they'll make that space. But that means if any of y'all like know anybody or have something to say, like you two, like, you know, like this isn't like shouldn't be people talking at you. Like, we're all, you know, doing the same shit.
So I wanted to mention, before we go on, that the United States government won't even acknowledge the existence of political prisoners within its borders. And if they did, they would have to acknowledge their violent racist history, as well as the real revolutionary movements that have resisted and challenged this history. In addition, the United States is the only country in the world where the acknowledgement and support of these political prisoners is treated as a separate job, a separate element of radical movements as a whole. The government's insistence to erase them informs this reality, and we have to really fight to include them in our struggle. They are people who have been strategically attacked for being black, for being brown, for being revolutionary, and for being willing to adhere to these revolutionary principles in their lives and for the entirety of their incarcerations. And I wanted to quote Ojeri Lutalo, who's a former political prisoner, and he says, any movement that fails to support its political internees is a sham movement. We must support our political prisoners as we support the very political movements they came from, helped and continue to help build, because it's not like they go to jail and they're no longer building the movements that we are also building. And as Joe said, when you're writing to political prisoners, it's not just, I mean, yes, they're our elders and we respect them for that, but they continue to influence us and they continue to be a part of really building these movements. And so writing is one of the ways we can really get their opinions about things and their guidance.
Yeah,
too.
And just like I'm working on some food justice work in the South Bronx right now with the APOC collective, actually, that's forming in out of the New York APOC folk, or a few of us. And I saw Herman Bell on Christmas and with this person here, and we don't use names sometimes in these mixed crowds. it was like the best Christmas I've had for a variety of reasons, other than the fact I hate my family, you know. But it's, that's neither here nor there. And he did work with Jaleel. Jaleel was also on Victory Gardens, right? It was,
or, yeah,
and about, like, you know, community gardening stuff before it was like all the rage, and like like right now, like, you know, I'm hoping that he'll, you know, get back to me sooner about like some questions I have about like, you know, how to do this work that we're doing now, and, you know, and like, and it's just cool to be able to like get it from a source that is like tried and tested in terms of like putting, yeah.
And I don't know if people in this room are familiar with movements in the 60s and 70s and 80s. I'm sure everyone is, but I felt like I had to kind of give a little brief statement and please add in. And so, because we can't truly understand the torture of the long sentences given to and refusal to even acknowledge the presence of political prisoners in the United States, if we do not first understand the political movements and historical moment they operated within, as well as what the U.S. government's violent response was to them. In the late 50s, the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, these were decades of real revolutionary action in the United States and all over the world. This country was engaged in an immoral, imperialist, and racist war in Vietnam and engaged in this same kind of war at home here in the United States. People of color were resisting all over the country, and this resistance challenged the very economic and social mechanisms that had historically and presently allowed America to develop into and exist as a global superpower. This resistance challenged the violent systemic racism, brutality, and exploitation that the United States was founded on and relies upon still. The government responded to these movements with the same violence, with water hoses, police dogs, beating, and murder. And still, these movements grew. They demanded and fought for the self-determination of people. The Black Panthers emerged, the Young Lords, and the American Indian Movement, just to name a few. These organizations exposed the racist practices of the U.S. both in communities and on a larger scale. And they pushed forth dynamic revolutionary leaders who activated communities physically, intellectually, and psychically. White anti-imperialists, both in the universities and on the street, dedicated their lives to ally with and act in solidarity with many of these movements. And one by one, the U.S. government systematically criminalized, incarcerated, or killed many of these leaders. And I don't think we can go forward without talking about COINTELPRO, which most people know about, but I'm just going to talk about a little anyway. So COINTELPRO was a government program directed against these movements, and it's understanding COINTELPRO is central to understanding the government's wars and repression against progressive movements then and now, too. It represents the state's strategy to prevent movements and communities from overturning white supremacy and creating racial justice. It's both a formal program of the FBI and a term frequently used to describe a conspiracy among government agencies, local, state, and federal, to destroy movements for self-determination and liberation for Black, Brown, Asian, and Indigenous struggles, as well as to mount an institutionalized attack against allies of these movements and other progressive organizations. This was interesting. As I was thinking about talking here today, I was doing a little bit of research on COINTELPRO, and I didn't know that it began in 1956, mm-hmm. in part because frustration with Supreme Court rulings limiting the government's power to proceed overtly against dissident groups. And also, I thought this was interesting, too. The first five domestic threats that COINTELPRO had in their sights were the Communist Party, the Socialist Workers' Party, a white hate group, the Black nationalist groups, and a New Left program, which you can imagine what falls under that. I don't know if anybody else wants to jump in or if I can keep
going. The only piece that I was going to add, I think, in terms of COINTELPRO is that I think a lot of times folks contextualize it in a sort of historical past.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that what COINTELPRO really is the government's ability to basically do what they want to the peoples within that nation. So when we think about Patriot Act 1 and 2, when we think about a lot of the tactics, when we talk to our freedom fighters behind the walls, the wiretaps, you know, are now legal.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
they don't need
right.
COINTELPRO to engage in things like wiretaps, no-knock warrants, you know.
Right.
Particularly now with, you know, like with cases like the San Francisco 8 mm-hmm. and Kamal Siddiqui, mm-hmm. we're finding that they're pulling up cold cases from the 60s right. and 70s,
yeah.
talking about they got new DNA. And, you know, and for a lot of us, it's like, these are elders. You know what I mean? Like,
they're in their 70s.
They're in their 70s. Cats is like playing Little League. They're like Little League coaches,
mm-hmm.
you know, out in Queens that are now getting roped into trials. So, I mean, I think for us, like, a lot of times when we talk about it, a lot of folks sort of contextualize, like, oh, that was the 60s, that was the 70s. But it's like, tell that to Kamal Siddiqui,
right,
who was the other day, Little League softball coach in Queens, they pulled a 20-year cold case, homicide case. Mm-hmm. San Francisco 8, the same thing.
Right.
So I think just in terms of COINTELPRO, it's just the context of it is it's a historical program. Patriot Act made all of the tactics legal, and they're still, you know, using those tactics, even against, there's another sister named Reverend Joy Powell, who's
right
up in Bedford Hills right now, who's an anti-violence activist out of Rochester, New York. You know, she did a lot of, she was engaged in anti-violence and anti-police brutality work. They hit her with burglary charges, mm-hmm, typical, you know, typical sort of thing. She didn't engage in that. And then they just hit her with a 20-year, a homicide case from 20 years ago, which they're going to throw another 20 years on her.
That's right, yeah.
So it's the thing of, like, even though the COINTELPRO program is something that may have, is now public, for lack of a better
term. Right. I think
which led to her being raped in prison.
Right.
Just
right,
so you know.
Yeah. I think, too, when you're talking about that, when you're talking about the case of the SF8, where all of the information gathered was gathered under torture when torture was illegal, but now that torture is legal, they can use that to justify also bringing up this stuff. I mean, I was going to talk a little bit about why people are locked up for so long, why political prisoners are locked up for so long. The government has a vested interest in both punishing revolutionaries by giving them unfounded sentences and also in criminalizing their actions. As we're talking about, COINTELPRO sought to destroy all black political organizations in the U.S. by any means necessary. Its operation is largely responsible for the deaths and imprisonment of a significant number of young black leaders of the 60s and 70s. And just to build off what he was saying, it initiated the search and destroy missions under the guise of criminal investigations, and now all of these things can happen under law. So they have a vested interest in both punishing revolutionaries, and they systematically rob communities of revolutionary leaders in an attempt to erase them, erase their message, erase their actions, erase their commitment to revolutionary change, and in effect, erase our connection to this history. We need to know that people were doing this before and that there's a connection between that and now. And by putting these people away and locking them up forever and criminalizing them, you know, that link is destroyed. And they also preemptively warn us that if we do the work that they were doing, that we'll be locked up and thrown away too. So that's another reason why we really have to consider political prisoner work a part of our revolutionary work.
Sure. So now you have a little bit of background on where most of the political prisoners and prisoners of war are coming from in terms of politics and the programs that put them in prison. We're actually going to showcase a few different prisoners that are in New York State, particularly because, you know, they're close. Like, say, where to start a correspondence with them, you would be able to visit them. And, just wanting to give a sense of who's nearby in prisons. And then after that, we were just going to talk for a little bit about repression going on today, particularly with grand juries and anarchists and Earth and Animal Liberation, and then how you can support folks. And we're going to do this all very tight, very quick, so that we can have it be open and hopefully get a few letters started.
I wanted to just quickly say, too, that I've been visiting political prisoners my entire life.
Yeah.
And you know, these people are my family, mm-hmm, by proxy, from my parents who were active in the 60s and the 70s. And it's always really important to me to communicate the fact that these revolutionaries are magnificent,
yes,
and
yeah,
they're our elders, but they're also people.
Yes.
And they are people who pay the price for the rest of us. And they're people with an ongoing analysis, as I said before. They're people with families and partners and inner lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're talking about all of this, I always think it's important to just remember that they are people. And that's why it's important to highlight them as people, too.
So we were going to talk about Abdul-Majid. We're going to talk about Sekou Odinga. Talk about Herman Bell and Jill Muntkin. And also Maliki Shakur Lateen. So, do you all want to start with Sekou?
I was going to ask one.
Would you mind?
I can do Sekou.
Well, it's supposed to be an interactive panel.
Yeah, I
and
What do you know about Saquon? All right, I'll turn the mic in my direction.
Actually, I've been visiting Saquon Odinga several times in the most recent, because he recently came back. He was in federal prison. He was in the most horrible prisons. He was in Marion. He was in Leavenworth. They finally popped him off into that horrible Florence Admax, where everybody's, you know, basically in solitary confinement and locked in your cell, you know, except for like half an hour or a day, I think, when you might possibly get to go into the dog cage, which is supposed to be outside. So now he's here in New York. He got back in like August, I think, of last year, if I remember correctly. And we didn't, well, I work with New York City Jericho Movement, so we do this work too about political prisoners, like the ones that nobody wants to know about in New York State. And so Sekou, we didn't run up to see him immediately because he has a lot of family in this area, so we went to make sure, you know, his family got first dibs, of course. And he's just tremendous. I mean, as well as just being, he's got a great sense of humor, very funny. You know, also magnificent history. I went up to see him with De Cui, who works with the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee. And so she asked him, you know, what was your life like in Algeria? Because he was a representative of the Black Panther Party in Algeria. He was part of the international group that was out there. And that was very interesting. And we talked about a lot of things. And he said, you know, I thought I hated everything about the United States. But I found out there were some things I liked about the United States. Toilets, electricity, running water, washing machines, you know, things that, you know, we often take very for granted in this country that most of the world does not have access to. So, you know, it's just very, very human, you know, and it's very typical of visiting all the prisoners. Like you mentioned, Majid. This actually is, his name is not on the book for obvious reasons, but this is really Abdul Majid's baby. This was his book that he wrote with the cooperation of all the New York State political prisoners, and they're all in here. And as we can see, they are human beings. They have family. They have loved ones. Seth just got married in October. That's the one you're going to see up in Wendy. You know, they're very human people. Some of them have passed. Bashir passed, who was Majid's co-defendant. They would not even let him come home to die. You know, so, you know, this is real. These are real people, as you said, Onan. It's very important to remember that. You know, because people are like, oh, you know, well, symbolic, our freedom fighters. Yes, they are our freedom fighters. But they suffer too, you know. And they are very human people, and they love to have visits, you know. And I would encourage everybody who can, you know. Here's Lalit. You are Lalit, right? Lalit is saying they have a car. Well, this is great. Next time you go to visit Seth, let me know so I don't have to do that endless schlep on the bus. I'll move to
get up at 1 o'clock in the morning because, you know, Wednesday is 8 hours.
I don't mind getting up at 8. You know, I get up at any time to go to visit the prisoners. I get up at 2 a.m. to go get on a van. You know, I don't care. You know, I love to see these people. And they do, as you say, they enrich your lives.
It's really a privilege, I think.
It is a privilege to get to really know them, you know, and become friends with them. And then you have, like, a regular correspondence, or they'll call you on the phone. Like, today I was trying to get here at 11 o'clock in the morning. There was no way. For a Seth call, we were on the phone for half an hour. Somebody else tried to call twice. I don't, this new system is not as nice as the older one in that sense. So I had a late start. But Sekou is a prisoner of war, as you said already, because Sekou was, you know, doing an armed expropriation, you know, in order to gain some money for the movement, you know, which is something that, you know, if we're all in the movement, we all know. We have no money, right? So, you know, obviously, that was something that, you know, is serious, and that was a way that people did raise money.
Do you want to talk about, a little bit about what that term means, expropriation, in a revolutionary sense?
Well, in a revolutionary sense, it would be, you know, what if you weren't a revolutionary, it would be a robbery. You know, it would be like, okay, we're going to go hold up this Brinks truck, and we're going to take all that money, and then we're going to go take off to Tahiti. That would be a robbery. But if you're going to go hold up a Brinks truck and get this money and then use it for the struggle, that would be an expropriation, like the Machetetos did in 1983 when they did that Wells Fargo thing. And they did liberate a whole bunch of money, and they used it for the struggle. So that's an expropriation, as opposed to, you know, I'm just going to go hold up a bank because, you know, I'm unemployed and I have no money. You know, I'm just going to do it for myself. Well, that would be a robbery.
And so what's the sort of status of Sekou now? Because I know that for those that don't know, Sekou Odinga basically had federal time, which he served.
And now he's doing state
time. And now he's doing state time. So what did he have fed time for? What did he have state time for? And sort of what's
well,
the,
all those little legalities, I'm not even ooh, sure okay. I even know all those things.
We're going to let that go then, but sort of
I wouldn't say I'm not let it go. No, not for sure.
Okay.
Let me see what we say about St. Louis here, because we probably have something about it. I know he's trying to raise some money to do a lawsuit because something to do, and I do not understand all the little ins and outs of it, but something to do with the fact that the state released him to federal jurisdiction at some point in time, and so now there's some kind of legality where he can argue in court that since they did release him to federal jurisdiction, that he now does not have to come back to the state because they released him to the feds, which would mean if he could win that case, he could actually then be released. Which is important.
Because now, basically what they had given him was he had had federal time and
state time. Yeah.
But he spent time in both facilities. So the argument he's trying to make is that the state time that he's doing right now should have been tacked on to the federal time since he was in both state and federal prison.
Right.
So what he's trying to do right now is sort of acquire funds. There's a lawyer or two involved that are trying to help him with his appeals case. And again, if he is successful in this appeals case, again, he's now served over 35 years in the feds. You know, he will essentially get to go home.
So it would be a great day.
It would definitely be a blessing.
We don't know if that'll happen, but we'll certainly try.
I just wanted to say when I think of Sekou, I remember being a kid, and after Brinks happened in 81, he was tortured.
Yes, he was.
And I remember hearing about the torture that the government, you know, did perpetrate it on him. And, you know, pulling his fingernails out with a wrench and flushing his head down the toilet. And that just makes me think of how we talk about torture in this country, about something that happens like at Guantanamo or something that happens at Abu Ghraib. But really, these prisoners are tortured too. If you're a woman, you're raped, mm-hmm. you're sexually assaulted, and it's
fun.
Totally, it's all right. So it's just something to bring up. And that's not just something that happened to Sekou in the 80s, but something that continues to happen to the state-sanctioned torture.
Yes.
And I just think that's important to mention. And
as if, like, just CMU is alone or not, like, torture, you know?
Right,
it's like there's actually even the physical brutality element that, like, you figure, you know, doesn't happen here.
Yes, it does.
They just don't talk about it.
Yeah. About the torture, actually, that's good, because somebody had asked me to ask Sekou, you know, how did he withstand the torture? So we asked him, you know, said, okay, this is a legitimate question. Somebody asked us, and he said, you know, he said, they were really stupid. He said, you know, if they had said to me, let's go have a cup of coffee, I might have been a little bit more inclined to say something, which, of course, he wouldn't have done anyway. But he said, you know, I just got pissed off. He said, I just got pissed off, you know, that they had this damn, you know, ridiculous nonsense. And he said, after a while, you just get so mad, you don't even feel the pain anymore. He said, here they are, you know, they're doing all this stuff to him. And what do they want to know? Where is Asada? Where is Majid? Those were the questions they were asking him. Where is Asada? Where is Majid? And if you don't know where they are, who do you know who knows where they are? You know, but I thought that was a very interesting response, because he was like, you know, basically he said, I just got pissed off. How dare they do this to me? And then he said, I wasn't about to tell them anything after that. You know, so he said, you know, maybe if they would have come and said, you want to have a cup of coffee and sit and talk with us, which is another thing they do, and of course you don't want to talk with them, but you know, that would be a different tactic. He said, maybe if they had tried that, I might possibly have told them something.
Yeah.
I doubt it, but. It was just funny the way he said that, because we were doing demonstrations right outside in downtown Manhattan when that happened, denouncing the fact that the man was being tortured, which was documented and known. And people would say, right to your face, you know, we'd be like, here, take this, you know, this is a flyer about what's happening right now, right here at MCC. You know, this man is being tortured. Oh, that couldn't possibly be true.
Right.
This is the United States of America. I was like, yeah, you don't know your history, folk? This is a white settler state. Wake up and smell the roses, man. What do you think is going to happen? Yeah, that was in 1981, you know, and even now people are like, oh, we know about Guantanamo and all that, but and all the other torture, the psychological torture, the torture of not being able to see your family, the torture of, you know, all these things are torture, you know, not getting medical treatment when you need it. You know, that's
yeah.
horrible things. We've had several comrades die in prison. They would not even let them come home to die. So, you know, in my opinion, what this is all about for the prisoners is it's all about revenge on the part of the state. The state is very clear. You did something we didn't like, or you thought a thought that we didn't like, and we are going to punish you forever. because they're resentencing people in New York State now. We got Jaleel and Harmon coming up for parole for the fifth time, I believe.
Yeah.
Seth is the seventh time. So every time you go to the parole board and they give you a two-year hit, they're adding 2 years to your sentence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is resentencing people. And I will say that freely because Bob Boyle already said it. It was true. They are resentencing people. They have decided, the U.S. government at some level, has decided that none of these political prisoners are going to get out alive. That's what they've decided. And they're doing it. That's not what we've decided. We say, F you. We are going to go after Patterson. We've got a whole petition here for people to sign for all the New York State political prisoners. What does he want to be remembered as? The accidental governor, you know, who did nothing? Or he could actually do a great thing for his community and say, okay, I will pick up a pen. You know, how hard is it? I can pick up a pen and sign a piece of paper. You know, we know all these politicians are spineless. That's how they get to be politicians.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're going to talk to them now, because if he's not planning to do anything else in politics, he's got nothing to lose and a lot of respect to gain from his community if he does that.
You both know who Patterson is. He's the governor.
The governor of New York. The accidental governor of New York.
Yeah. Patterson area. So where are we at?
Well, I mean, I know we wanted to talk a little bit about Harmon and Jaleel.
Yeah.
And so if you want to do that, that would be great.
Yeah. Oh, I was asked to speak about Sekou.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I can't.
The whole thing is kind of like.
Okay,
because remember, like.
What are you talking about?
Remember, like.
The, so you can talk about her and
whatever.
Don't talk about Sekou.
Huh? Dude, Jaleel, I know probably the least about Jaleel in this group here. Or just like I've not been to see him. Other people here have been to see him. I recently started corresponding with him because you know, at MXGM, like in the PP committee, you get assigned not assigned, but like you're like you can you're encouraged to take up a correspondence with an individual, and you kind of bottom line, you know, needs of that individual. Like one of the things that we're doing is the other person who writes to Jaleel with me are putting together a thing, the PP POW pantry, where we're just bringing food up. We're going to try to bring like fresh fruits and vegetables up to people. Because who was it who started that? Was it like who asked? Was it Sekou that? Yeah, Sekou were like said like, I can't get any fresh fruits and vegetables up here. Please bring them up. So then we're like, why? Like we shouldn't do that for everybody. Like just like, so what the hell? So we're seeing about doing that now, and we'll bring some up with when we see Jaleel. Jaleel is an intense character. What?
So I mean, Jaleel Muta King. Brother is like
tall guy,
like 6'12", right? And
that tall.
I mean, with Harmon and Jaleel, again, like for me, going to visit them, it makes me want to do the work more.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, for sure.
This is crazy kind of thing.
Well,
like,
it's true.
You come up to visit folks, and you're like, "Well, I'm here to, you know, show you we still got the movement going on." And you come in, and Jaleel in particular has this vibe about him,
it's
like he's not even locked up. Like he meeting you. Like on the corner, and y'all are having, you know, some water just chilling, you know.
Yeah.
We went, the first time I went to go see Jaleel, what struck me about him was, so, we're up in Auburn, and you know, all the other inmates are like this, you know, looking around for the guards, talking to the families. Jaleel comes in, it's like he owns the fucking place, you know what I'm saying?
And
for
everybody.
Him, you know, he's like 6'4", it's really crazy. But I think, you know, when for me, and again, a lot of what like Jaleel and Harmony gets personal, not so much about their case, it's just, They're educators, you know. Jaleel got a master's degree and a bachelor's behind the walls.
Yeah.
He's taught history behind the walls. He's taught sociology behind the walls. He's written at least 5 books on liberation struggle behind the walls.
Even the pigs credit him many times for stopping riots because he has that about him.
And so the thing with Jaleel, and again, you know, a lot of it for me is personally, like, it hurts when he comes up for parole.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, you've done all this work with folks behind the walls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've written all of these books.
Yeah.
But like Ann was saying, you know, your politics is saying, right?
The son of the man that you are accused of killing comes out to support you come parole time.
Yes,
and you still don't get it.
I think one of the stories I love about Jaleel is that my godfather's in prison in California. He's been in prison for 40 years. And
wow.
He was not a political prisoner when he went in, but he went in and he was on death row in
wow.
San Quentin. And when he came off of death row in the 70s, he was there in San Quentin when George Jackson was killed.
Wow.
And he heard the screams on death row. And he came out of death row, and Jaleel was the first person to talk to him in San Quentin. And he organized him. And from that moment on, my godfather, whose name is Kalima,
he was a Panther in San Quentin, and he began to write for the political newspapers that people were organizing on the outside. Mm-hmm. And he is a political man now. And when I go and visit, you know, I visited Jahlil in San Francisco, which we'll talk about the SF8 case a little bit, but when Jahlil and Herman got brought to San Francisco to face these other charges that were 30 years old, which Lalit mentioned before, you could only visit them behind glass. Mm-hmm. And you could visit them for 30 minutes. And oftentimes you're sharing a 30-minute visit with somebody else. So mm-hmm. you have 15 minutes. And the same spirit that you're talking about, it's like he's not even in there. He's just like on the phone with you, talking to you. And he's a really beautiful man. And, yeah. and he's a great person to visit and communicate with. And he hasn't given up. Like, he's like, I'm about to get out of here, so you better be ready for me when I get out of here. And he has so many plans mm-hmm. and so many revolutionary things that he still wants to do, and that he wants to, you know, other people to pick up the work and go on to.
And I think so. Herman Bell, can we get to Herman Bell?
Sure.
Maybe like I'm interjecting just because I'm looking at the time business and we want to like get things out. Is this like a good place to segue? Like, because you think this might be a good place to segue into Maliki, because like we're talking about politicized prisoners and that's maybe something to introduce, because he was a politicized prisoner, right?
He also wrote a statement to share with everybody.
Yeah, and I mean, would you like? I guess the difference. The difference between like a political prisoner and a politicized prisoner is like sometimes you go like you want to explain it, you can like cause, but it's pretty much people who get organized behind the walls and then they either then they you know sometimes like in the case of Maliki Shakur Lateen, in the case of like JoJo Bowen, who is pretty amazing, if you read about him, killed the warden of the prison with his bare hands.
Yes, he did.
Like when they started repressing Muslims, like he got organized by Panthers on the inside. It's like sometimes it just unlocks that, unlock that door, and then you've got people who come from this kind of background where society has like brutalized you, and then when you just find that voice and find that connection, like these folk become soldiers, straight up soldiers, and as this man here.
Yeah, so there was like a specific excerpt that he wanted to be read out loud, and then we'll get the full thing. Talked about.
Wait, you wrote a book, huh?
Yeah, he talks about what I think.
That's a lot to say.
Yeah, I mean, he has, that's when you're in prison, you have a lot of time to think. So he's developed, he has like a strong analysis of what's going on, and like that's another thing. Like, mm-hmm. a lot of these prisoners, they're intellectuals. You know what I mean? And like that's a resource. Like they're sitting there looking at what's going on and being able to have a political analysis of it. So you just wanted me to read this out loud, and he says, I've touched upon many aspects of the problems we face as manifested by the repressing and repressing conditions I've been witnessing during the past 3 decades of my imprisonment. History has repeatedly attested to, time and time again, the truth that our conditions shall not improve until we, both as individuals and a community, change our minds and then act and conduct ourselves in accordance with this change. Mm-hmm. To find and determine your own fate/destiny, in other words, live out or in accordance with the true meaning and spirit of self-determination. There are many things I'd like to say and share with all of you present, but this will suffice for now. The problems, which we all are confronted with from time to time and in our individual and collective lives, are but a test. It is a test in which we are to train and to develop our will and intellect in our struggle to ascend upon the path of consciousness, and quotes a couple different passages from the Quran. So with this, I shall conclude my statement, and I sincerely appreciate this precious opportunity to share these thoughts with you. With love and solidarity, forever your brother and friend, Maliki Shakur, the Black Dragon.
And since it is being documented, Holy Quran, verse 23, section 115, 17, section 70, 76, sections 1 through 2, 9, section 126, 4, section 1, 22, section 5, and section and 2, section 186. Just for whoever may archive this, I'm sure it's a really important one. He seems to be quite a fan of the Islam, so alas.
And then just to give a brief, very brief background on where he's coming from politically, he was in the Nation of Islam originally. He's from the Bronx. And then... What did you say?
Another Bronxite.
Yeah, and then moved into the Panther Party. He did... a short bit in Rikers where he met the Panther 21 that were locked up there at the time. When he came out of Rikers, he found the conditions that were created by COINTELPRO, like Ono was talking about, with a number of different party members being assassinated, and a lot of the members went underground and joined armed liberation movements, which he became a part of. Then, later down the line, he was rounded up in the course of an investigation of expropriations and was charged with murdering two cops that had pulled over a car at some point in Harlem. And as a result of that, they had gone around and were rounding up people who they saw as politically connected. Even though the evidence seems to point to him not being guilty of this, he was convicted, and then in the early 90s, had a conviction overturned, and then was reconvicted, and this is the case with many prisoners. They'll have 3-4 mistrials, and then finally they'll get it to stick, which is not how most people understand the justice system to work. But and he was given 25 to life, and unfortunately he just came up for parole and was denied. So you know that's and he loves corresponding with people and loves to get into political discussion, so that's someone that you correspond with. And then maybe it's time for one more really brief.
I mean, I thought maybe this is, I don't know if we want to talk a little bit about Herman, but then, and then talk, I think it's important to talk about the SF8 case, like mm-hmm. really important.
Yeah.
And it's also, that case is an important segue, I think, to talk about how anarchists, there's like a dragnet for anarchists right now. I can say a little bit about Herman, and people can add in. And Herman and Jaleel have both been in jail for over 30 years. And Herman is a really sweet man.
Yes, yes.
Every time I visit him, I'm struck by his thoughtfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And the letters, when I write to Herman, we talk about writing a lot and what it means to be a writer and what it means to write from prison, what it means to have a practice of writing. And
I think my thing with Herman, and again, we took about 13 people on Christmas by accident to go visit. They told us that it was a normal day. It wasn't. So we brought about 13 people up to visit Herman. And the thing about Herman that strikes me the most is the amount of organizing that one person can do behind the walls, outside the walls.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a project that he was telling us about called Victory Gardens, which basically working with farmers in Maine and upstate, bringing in fresh food and produce into African-American communities in Bed-Stuy in Harlem. And this is, you know, sort of late 90s, right? And MXGM actually did some of the food programs that was connected to that. So he's talking and he's explaining the ins and outs. Like, oh, you know, we had to have music for folks that were coming up. And he talks about all these ins and outs. And at some point it dawns on me, yo, dude, he was locked up the whole damn time. So his ability, and that for me is like, again, that's something that pushes me, is like the ability of someone like Herman, who is incarcerated, to be like, I'm still thinking about the people outside. I'm still thinking about how my people are going to eat. I'm still thinking about how do we provide and build support for others like myself. So I think for myself with Herman, it was sort of his ability to put you in a place and situation. Again, he's organizing from behind the walls, you know, for lack of a better term, community produce between Maine and Harlem and Bed-Stuy, New York, all while he's incarcerated. All of this is through letter correspondence and phone calls. Another thing that I was really impressed about when I went to go see him, too, was they do a political prisoner calendar every year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, you know, I have family members that are incarcerated, and they think about themselves. They like, when is my commissary coming?
Right. Yeah.
When you gonna come see me? Herman is like, yo, it's all of us that are in this together.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should come up with an idea that's going to raise funds collectively for our commissaries, for our legal funds.
Absolutely.
So they came up with the idea, and again, you're locked up, but you have connections up in Canada. I don't have connections up in Canada. Gets with some folks in Canada, and they start building and distributing basically political prisoner calendars that get sold for $15 every year, and that money goes into the commissaries of political prisoners and legal defense funds. But I think this is a good segue into the San Francisco.
That's great.
So just a little background on the SFA, and jump in if I miss something.
And the and that can segue into COINTELPRO protecting ourselves a bit, or that's a different part.
Well, I'm going to talk about the SFA case a little bit, and then after that we can talk about what's going on now and the attacks from the state now, and things that we can learn from this, because I think it's actually it's a good case to look at and learn from. So as we were saying, 8 former Black community activists, some of them who are Black Panthers, were arrested on January 23rd, 2007 in California, in New York, and in Florida on charges related to the 1971 killing of a San Francisco police officer. Similar charges had been thrown out, like I was saying before, after it was revealed that police used torture to extract confessions when some of these men were arrested in New Orleans in 1973. And I just want to name these men, because I think we talk about people, we don't name them. And they're Richard Brown, Richard O'Neill, Ray Boudreau, Hank Jones, Francisco Torres, Herman Bell, and Jaleel Muntakim, who were already incarcerated for 30 years in New York, but were brought out to San Francisco from the state prisons that they're in. So sort of a holding tank in San Francisco where they hold people while their trials are happening, but they were held there for two years.
Yeah.
And the conditions there were terrible. It was, I mean, every time, I mean, also the thing about Jaleel, I just have to mention, he's like, I like clothes. I like my clothes and I like my shoes. And we'll talk about it. And like, it's really
That's
funny,
Jaleel.
But there, you know, they were in there in like, it was unhygienic in there.
Yeah.
I'll just put it like that. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's another kind of torture, too, is to strip people of their dignity and of things like that.
Just to interject really quickly, I had him for 2.5 years. If any of you have ever been in the Tombs in New York, I don't know if folks have. But imagine sort of being in, if you've ever been to a precinct and you see the cells there, imagine being in the cell in the precinct or in the Tombs for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
They were basically, because they were under the property of, they were state property, for lack of a better term, they were housed on the same floor as all of the mental illness patients.
Mm-hmm.
So for 2.5 years, you know, some of the liberties, quote unquote, they had while they're in state facilities,
that's right,
they're in holding cells that are really supposed to be for people waiting to go to trial,
mm-hmm,
and they spent 2.5 years there.
Yeah.
And they, I mean, one of those things was, one of the liberties is that they were never allowed to go outside.
Mm-hmm.
So They were locked up. They didn't have contact visits. And we can talk a little bit more about that later. But Harold Taylor, also one of the men who was arrested, along with John Bowman, who was recently deceased, and Reuben Scott, who is thought to be a government witness,
mm-hmm,
were first charged in 1975. And a judge tossed out these charges, too, finding that Taylor and these co-defendants also made statements under torture.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to talk about the torture a little bit, which is that they employed electric shock, cattle prods to their genitals, beatings, sensory deprivations, plastic bags over their heads, hot, wet blankets for asphyxiation, and such evidence is neither credible or legal. But like we were talking about before, you know, torture is legal now. So these laws are changing, and information gathered from things like this, we'll see that change more too. At the end of July, Herman Bell and Jaleel Muntakim were sentenced to probation and time served, and all charges were dropped on Richard Brown, Hank Jones, Harold Taylor, and Ray Boudreau, with the prosecution admitting it had insufficient evidence against them. So I think, I can't remember what the, it was like millions and millions of dollars spent on this case where they didn't have any evidence, and the state's just wasting money on this for a variety of different reasons. And the only person who's left is Cisco Torres, who lives in Queens, and he's refusing to take deals that they're trying to give him, which is like 5 years probation, I think,
mm-hmm,
because he knows he's innocent. And,
yeah,
and he also, one of the great things that we keep talking about these political prisoners is Cisco's told me, I see this as an opportunity to educate people.
Absolutely.
So as long as this case is open, I can go around the country talking about this and organizing,
mm-hmm,
around this and connecting this case to the open cases that I think people in this room are familiar with, and cases that will continue to come up. So, yeah.
So,
what's that?
Doesn't he have court Monday?
Yeah, actually, he does. He has
April
court Monday 19th,
right?
In San Francisco, April 19th. So.
So just in the interest of time, because I think it's really important to just open it up to some discussion, letters, and that kind of stuff. Just wanted to very quickly point out that there's two grand juries open in New York right now, in case some of you don't know. They're specifically targeting anarchists. And there's a group of people that Owen and I are part of, the People's Law Collective, that's providing support for folks to resist the grand juries. And, you know, you can talk to us after if you want the contact information. It's nycplc.info. But basically the bottom line is we're encouraging people insisting that people not talk in these grand juries. Like, you will be supported, but you have to recognize that if you talk in a grand jury, not only are you possibly leading to the indictments of friends or comrades, you also might be possibly leading to your own indictment. Mm-hmm.
I think another piece of that, too, is we were talking about it at the beginning, about really considering this work part of the revolutionary work that we're doing. And we have to really build, you know, whatever you want to call it, to support people who are resisting the grand juries, mm-hmm. and to support people who are going into jail now, so that they feel like they don't have to talk, so that they feel like when they go in, they're really going to be supported. And we have to build that kind of line where mm-hmm. where people That's know true. that they're supported when they go into yeah. jail, or supported when they stand in front of these grand juries.
And so that's that. And then in terms of obviously, since this was about support, I mean, we talked about what constitutes a political prisoner, like who's a prisoner of war. I think we touched on how to reach out to prisoners that you want to support, in terms of first contacting folks through letters, then, you know, building up to visits, phone calls, developing relationships. We touched on food packages, which is a big program in New York State, that if folks are interested in helping with, particularly financially, because it is expensive to send food packages to folks. You know, you can either visit MXGM's website or ABC's website. We have information on both of them. I think it'd be probably best to open it up now, right? And then maybe lead into a little bit of letter writing.
Yeah.
So, any questions?
Things y'all was unclear about, things that when we said stuff, y'all like, what the fuck are y'all talking about?
Comments?
Because sometimes we start talking like PP language.
But, yeah,
I just want to make sure that.
Yeah. As far as political prisoners in the U.S., are there any numbers as far as what, you know?
Right now it's higher than it was a couple of years ago because of a lot of the earth and mm-hmm. and animal liberation.
Like 100 or something?
It's about 110
now.
And then there's also grand jury resistors right now, but hopefully they're not going to be in there much longer. So that's enough there.
I'd also say, I don't know if ABCF, I know Jericho has a pretty, I don't know if y'all have a listing of,
mm-hmm.
Okay, so I guess ABCF or the Jericho Movement, I know MXGM, we use both of their websites as a listing of all 110 with names and mailing addresses for which so Jericho Movement or ABCF
net.
And we know we don't have everybody. You know, there are people who have been down for years who are just in prisons where they can't even say that they're a political prison.
And people
that repression is that people in Virginia who've been down for years that we know are political prisoners, but who say, please do not put me on your list because I will be retaliated against by the guards. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are those kind of situations too. So the list is not exhaustive. You know?
And if you find somebody that seems interesting, you can always feel free to like cross-reference do your like research, because a lot of times like people will have like independent support sites, mm-hmm. and like people like can get like switched from place to place like really quickly sometimes, and like I've had like stuff come back on me because somebody got transferred in the interim of my letter. So
Can you give this presentation like for people who maybe aren't sympathetic? Like, what happens? Do you give this kind of a presentation to like audiences who aren't as sympathetic to revolutionary struggle? And then how do you frame it? Because I know you can frame it to us in a certain way, and I'm just curious because I feel like, you know, when you just have everyday conversations with people, they're kind of like,
well,
if they broke the law, what did they expect?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually just went to I don't know if you were there. I know Anne was there. The Riverside Church presentation.
Did you teach them at Lower Lehigh?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. But that's an interesting question. I think an important question too, because at a certain level, you're preaching to the choir, talking to people who already have revolutionary politics. But you know, as we're really trying to get these people out of jail, you have to have all kinds of different techniques and tactics, as Anne was talking about. You know, going to Patterson, and this thing at Riverside Church was really like an example of that, because it was a panel that was designed to talk to other kinds of people,
right,
and people who may not have the same politics.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I found it very useful to be in the audience of that panel too, because it was so far reaching and because it was a new tactic that I hadn't seen. And I think the the ideology of the people on the panel was that we're trying to get these people out. And however principled way we can do this, I mean, nobody's going to do anything that's unprincipled.
Absolutely.
But whatever principled, you know, way we can do this, it's at that point right now to do that. So.
Did you want? I was going to mention the approach, like MXGM. You know, we do our support release work, and I'm late because of different. You can only do the same thing so many times and have it fail. And we found a lot of times we're being these people are like prisoners of war. They are freedom fighters, and in the end, that's not something that the people that have the power to do anything about it are going to care about, and it'll just further infuriate them. So now we're more taking the angle of these folk have been in for how long? Their ability to reoffend is nil. They've excellent behavior records. If their behavior records were in any way impugned, it's maybe because they are a diabetic and were denied their insulin,
right,
and their blood sugar goes ridiculous, and they have an incident, and then they get cited for misbehavior,
yeah,
for having a seizure. You know, and other stuff.
I mean, I think too, for someone like Jaleel, who's been in jail since he was 19, he's done his time. And however you can, present that, again, I want to stress, with in a principled way.
Right.
You know, people are trying to figure out how to do that and get him out.
Right.
I mean, I think for myself, and sort of reference to your question, folks that are in the choir, when I've done work with young folks, or with folks I guess you wouldn't consider part of the choir, I think it's two pieces. One is the framing of it.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about Nelson Mandela,
yeah,
and that sort of, that's the international political prisoner. He did 26 years down and became head of the ANC. So I think with young folks, it's sort of talking about Nelson Mandela. Martin Luther King was incarcerated for a particular period of time. So I think when you start with young people, I usually put those two up, because those are people that they recognize as oh yeah, they're Martin Luther King's a great guy, Nelson Mandela, so is Jaleel Mutai King, so is Sekou Odinga. So sort of framing it, so with the younger folks, I frame it from that perspective. And then there's another program I do some work in where we sort of tie it in again with some of the prison abolition work, because they're facing unjust sentences in the same way that we talk about African people facing unjust sentences when it comes to crack cocaine,
right,
when it comes to, women being locked up for 15, 20 years for carrying a little crack on. So I think, in terms of not talking to the choir, she was saying, principled, but also how you frame it. So like I said, with some folks, I frame it from the Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King perspective. From other folks, it's framing it from the entire, it's a, really an entire prison issue. And political prison is sort of one piece within that. Does that sort of help? You can't ask no questions. You got to let other people go.
I wanted to respond to one.
I messed with you. I know Anne, so I apologize.
We messed with each other.
I'm bashing
the audience. I was just going to say that we recently were very successful because we were talking to the Riverside Church Prison Ministry, who obviously they do prison work. They don't necessarily support political prisoners, And we were able to get their endorsement for this campaign we're doing to Patterson because we spoke to them from the human rights perspective. If you have people who've already done their time and have been turned down for parole so many times, that's obviously a human rights violation, however you want to look at it. And if you have people who need medical care in prison who are not getting it, that's also a human rights violation. So when you speak to people, religious people, in those terms, and they love the book, the guy who's the chair of the thing, he grabbed this book on January 16th, he read it twice, and then he invited us to what to do their next meeting. So, it was very successful. But that's another way when you're working around with the religious community and people like that, there is a human rights issue, and it should be talked about, And I would just like to say, since we have the moment that we have with us, Ojere, who is one of our former political prisoners, just got out last year, and Bonnie Kernetz, who works with the Stop Max campaign at AFSC, which are two very important people here. So I personally would like to give a round of applause to both of them.
Bonnie can talk about intellectual prisons.
A question from the person in the corner.
So incarceration and legal charges and financial charges can obviously have a lot of negative effects on one's body and mind.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And support system. And sometimes some people can make choices to act out at those around them, those supporting them. And I know firsthand that that's true. I obviously can't really speak to like the larger population of sports or anything. But have any of you ever had experiences where that has happened? Like where prisoners have been dealing with substance issues or perpetrating sexual violence or anything like that? And like, what was that experience like? What have you heard about that? And how did you feel?
I think for myself, and again, we started for the past year and a half, have done visits once a month. So in terms of that particular piece, we've typically found, obviously, folks are just happy to have visitors. So there hasn't sort of been that sort of, we haven't gotten to that sort of level like what you're talking about. However, we also deal with children of some of these freedom fighters. So, you know, we sort of have heard from children about some of those pieces around, like, folks being shut down, you know, prisoners, you know, some of our freedom fighters being like, well, you know, I feel fucked up that I can't get to see my child, you know, who was born at 3 and they're now 21, and how do I deal with that? And then on the flip side, how do the children then deal with, you know, their father in particular being incarcerated? So in reference to the other pieces, I haven't really seen that except for, like I said, in some cases, like, you know, we specifically reach out to children, you know, like, oh, we're going to go see your pops, come through. And it's kind of like, you know, let me fall back, you know. But in reference to, I know, like, again, we've gone for the past year and a half. With us, we've sort of found, again, prisoners very sort of, folks just like, we just happy someone coming to see us, you know. I've heard of one particular situation. I'm not going to talk about it. But there had been one situation in which some correspondence sort of went the wrong direction for the person writing them, which they felt constituted some of what you were talking about in a letter perspective. I don't know if that necessarily answered what you were looking for.
And mostly, I guess, I'm thinking of a situation where the person had gotten out. And then there was a community of strangers who
attempted
to support them.
Oh, I mean, that's a joke. I know.
Apologies, I'm sorry. I read your question wrong.
Oh, and I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I still, yeah, no, I mean, I'm corresponding with somebody right now who's involved in like eco politics, and like he just got to writing me back after many months and was like very kind of like aggressive, but then was like, I'm really sorry if I've been aggressive, like this is just the way I talk to people, and now I have, I'm not mentioning anybody, but I had, like, someone come up to me and be like, actually, I've heard of a lot, like, that this person's been perpetrating, like, a lot of, like fucked up gender violence stuff, and, like, you know, like be wary of how much support you dole out to this person. It's like, and I don't even know how to, I don't even know how to approach these things. I'm just, so I have no idea. And, like, I think about that a lot in the community, because it's like, sometimes with like assault, like assaults that are perpetrated by members of the community and like people who may or may not have been incarcerated or whatever, and it's like a lot of the times it's just like I don't know how to deal with them, and it scares me because I'm like, if I don't know how to deal with this person who has my politics and worldview for the most part, how am I going to deal with the folk that scare me in the street, you know, that like I don't have a mutual political language to deal with them, and who like don't necessarily even want to be on the page that I'm on, or like, you know, so I don't know, but that's a good question.
Well, I was just gonna say, I mean, there's been a couple different folks who either on the outside have run into troubles regarding like sexual assault or sexual harassment and that kind of stuff, and then folks on the inside, like me. There's one prisoner in particular who were supporting, and then basically in the process of their incarceration, we're pretty sure became a white supremacist. And I mean, given what prisons are, like, you know, that is a possibility for that kind of thing can happen. And so, like, the tact we took was to stop officially supporting them and like took them down off of lists and stuff like that, but continue to engage in dialogue, because it's sort of like, you know, I mean, obviously this is depending on the situation, but like, for example, with someone like a perpetrator of sexual assault, it's like, obviously there's two reactions you can have to that, and like, one, not making judgments on either one, but like, one is like to say, you know, get the fuck out of here, you can't be around here at all, and then the other is like to say, these are the things that you need to be doing right now, and like, we're going to be enforcing that you do these things, and like, if possible, like that, you know, like, for example, like with the white supremacists, like, we tried to engage as much as possible to try and like talk through where they were coming from and try and like steer them away from that, and like, or like with perpetrators of sexual assault, to try and like on the outside hold them accountable and like make people aware of their history, so that people can have the autonomy to decide whether or not they want to associate with that person, but like to still in some ways like keep them close, so it's not like they're being sent out to a community that will have no idea where they're coming from, mm-hmm. that possibly lead to more of that stuff happening. So it's like, it's hard though, it's hard. I mean, you know, prison fucks people up, you know what I mean? Like, I have friends that did time, and like they're just not the same, you know what I mean? Like, and like, people have different experiences, and it's good that you bring that up, because like, that's totally a reality.
I think, you know, it does go back to what we've been saying over and over, is that if we really start considering political prisoners a part of our revolutionary movements, then we start building up the capacity to deal with situations like this and really take them seriously.
Yeah.
And to deal with, yes, the fact that prison does fuck you up, and to be able to have the capacity to help people when they come out and to deal with the different conflicts that come out. But unless we really engage in making this work a part of our work and as important as the rest of the work, you know, that stuff is harder to deal with, I think.
So we got one more.
Will you go a little bit more into some of the grand jury stuff, like what people can do to effectively resist that kind of harassment, and what people can do to support people who are resisting it?
I mean, so basically how it's been working thus far has been, there's been one confirmed person that's been subpoenaed to the Manhattan grand jury. There's also one in Brooklyn, and they seem to be overlapping in terms of their focus on anarchists. You know, there's some general idea of what they might be about. Like, it might be related to the bicycle bomber, if folks remember that, because that pisses them off that they haven't caught that guy. And, you know, or like general anarchist organizing, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on, and so they want to shut it down. And so this one person has been subpoenaed, and he has a lawyer from National Lawyers Guild who's been very supportive of this, and they've been advising him. And basically how it works is, like, so say you get your subpoena, right? A grand jury generally runs for 18 months. And at the end, they can renew it for another 18, but they usually don't. And so once you get that subpoena, basically the clock is running, right? So say, you know, like, say 8 months go by, and then you get brought into the court, and they expect you to testify. You go in and you say, I have nothing to say, like, pleading the fifth or whatever. Then the judge at that point has the option of sending you to jail to coerce you into talking. And the legal distinction, I guess, is basically that they're supposed to not keep you in there if it seems like it will have no effect on you talking. It's a really strange thing. So it's like, it actually is beneficial for you if you are just like, from the start, like, fuck this, I'm not talking, I have no intention of talking, I don't care how long you lock me up for, I'm still not going to talk, and like, have people that are backing up being like, no, they're not going to say shit, like, you know what I mean? So, and so, say, you know, you're 8 months into this process, that happens, the judge sends you to jail, you go, These are both federal grand juries, so you would go either to MCC or MDC, which are the two federal jails, one in Brooklyn, one in Manhattan. And basically, you sit there for, and you could sit there for up to, I guess, the remaining time would be 10 months. So you could sit there for up to 10 months. That hasn't been the case for most people. There was a case of this guy, Josh Wolf, out on the West Coast, who was the longest held grand jury journalist or something. He was held, I think, for the full 18. But basically, the bottom line is, if you continually make it clear that you are not going to be talking, you will get out sooner. And beyond that, your doing so prevents them from sending out further subpoenas. Like, the more encouragement they get on the front end, the more people they're going to be bringing in. And it's like this snowball effect. So, like, the person right now who is resisting is, it's great, because it's like, as far as we know, folks in our circles, no one else has been subpoenaed so far. And it's a result of this person standing up against it. And, you know, again, just to remind folks, like, the People's Law Collective, nycplc.info, like, we're around to hook people up with lawyers and legal advice and actual, like, support material otherwise for when people are inside, because, like, you will be supported.
I just wanted to add, I think it's important for people to really realize that these are scare tactics.
Yes.
And that is what they are. They are designed to terrorize you. They are designed to scare you. And you don't have to be scared,
right,
because you will be supported if you're subpoenaed and if you don't talk. And also that people really need to, you know, the state is not fucking around right now in terms of privacy and all the things we were talking about historically, COINTELPRO, and what that's become now and what is legal now to do. So people need to be really careful and take it seriously.
So we have, like, 3 minutes left, so there may not be letter writing.
We have to be out of here by 4:30, they say, so, like, if people... I think we have the space till 4:30 if people wanted to, like, chill or do whatever, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, like whatever, we
originally were going to, you know, try to engage people in a letter writing thing, like we start writing a letter, and if you're still interested in that, we have paper and everything, and we could provide you with info, or if you just want an opportunity to, like, you know, talk more about this or whatever, like, you know, we're the last people in here today, so you don't have to rush out, we just have to be out of here by 4:30. Yeah.
I was going to say, these petitions, which I mentioned earlier, but some people were not here yet. There's two, actually, for only one reason. I will explain why there are two. Because the one for Jaleel, officially known in New York State as Anthony Bottom, if you write to Jaleel, do not write to him as Jaleel Lipsky, and they will send it back to you, even if you put on his proper number. Anyway, this was started when he was in California, and he has a faith case, and it's already got several hundred signatures, so we're keeping it apart for the moment. And then this is for everybody else that we talked about, because we are, and there are signatures on the back ones already. So I'm going to pass them each way with its corresponding pen. Anybody who would like to sign, and sign. If you want to know more about them.
Is that the same as the online petition for you?
Yeah, that is the same
as
the online
petition.
So if I
signed it online.
If you signed it online, you don't need to sign it.
And I just also, it could be my fault.
This is a beautiful
One of the folks we didn't talk about was a sister named Safia Bukhari. Bukhari, former Panther, she transitioned to the Elders. When we talk about political prisoners, when we talk about freedom fighters, prisoners of war, this sister in particular did a lot in terms of some of the support work for formations like Jericho and for other sort of pieces. So we're just doing, believe, some flyers out there at the end of the month. We're just there was a book that was put out called The War Before.
Yeah.
Safia wasn't really big on writing, so it's basically essays from folks like Mia, from her daughter, who talks sort of about her life as a Panther, as part of the BLA, but also her work in sort of the 80s and 90s around, you know, doing work on behalf of political prisoners. So if y'all are available, the panelists... Yeah, it's next Sunday. Her daughter is going to be one of the panelists. Brother named Ashanti Alston, Laura Whitehorn, who's a former North American political prisoner.
There'll be food.
And Benjamin Ramos, who's from another formation called Brotherhood, specifically political prisoner work as it relates to Puerto Rican and Cuban political prisoners.
Right.
So if folks got some time availability, I'm going to leave it up here.
I've
definitely come through.
So if you signed the online petition for Julio, then you can sign that, which most of you probably have. But in case anybody has not, and then the other one is the one for everybody.